ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
We'll never be able to hear the words Beef Wellington again without thinking of Erin Patterson. Found guilty of murdering her in-laws, Gail and Don Patterson, Gail's sister, Heather Wilkinson, and the attempted murder of Gail's husband, Ian Wilkinson, Erin is currently serving a life sentence at the Dame Phyllis Frost Centre, a maximum security women's prison in the western suburbs of Melbourne. Now, most likely you've listened to podcasts, read thousands of words of news coverage, maybe watched the specials already out there, but still want more, because there's something about this case that has us hooked. Perhaps the most anticipated in the flurry of post-trial books is the Mushroom Tapes, sightings of Helen Garner, Sarah Krasnostein, and Chloe Hooper in Morwell Courtroom No. 4 sparked speculation of a trio of true crime books. Instead, they teamed up. Three journalists, three true crime specialists, three women discussing the case, and the woman at the centre of it. Who is Erin Patterson? And what the hell was she thinking? We have one member of this true crime supergroup with us tonight. Chloe Hooper is a multi-award-winning author of two novels and three books of non-fiction, including The Tall Man and The Arsonist, and now co-author of The Mushroom Tapes. Chloe, welcome to Nightlife.
Hello, it's lovely to be with you.
Now, you seem to have had mixed feelings about being drawn into the volumes of coverage on this case. What were your concerns? Can you take us through it?
This trial became so huge. It became a kind of cultural phenomenon. And I suppose when you go to a trial, you almost have to kind of do a body scan of what are the ethics of getting involved. And I guess also there was just such a lot of coverage. You wonder if, our voices were going to, add in a helpful way.
Right. And not just a cultural phenomenon, global phenomenon. I mean,
it's a global phenomenon, actually, as the weeks wore on and this trial went for double the time that was anticipated. There were more and more media outlets, waiting outside the courtroom, and journalists were leaving the court to do a cross to New York or London. There were countries all over the world where people were completely riveted by this. And of course, there were amazing daily journalists who were giving the public kind of almost minute by minute updates on what was happening.
What is it that got people so hooked on this case?
Well, I think that female murderers do sort of have a particular fascination to the public, and particularly in this case, where as women and sometimes as mothers, food is supposed to be a nurturing thing, and this is a complete reversal of that archetype, I suppose. I think that it's people, everybody has a family member or knows somebody who has had a complicated separation. I think that there's a sort of very domestic nature of this. People sort of, think, oh, that could be, my, insert family member. And so I think that people relate to it on those terms as well. But it is mysterious that it this traveled around the world the way that it did.
And certainly I think, I've had to do a couple double takes, when I've seen pictures of Erin, I've gone, geez, that could be me, just your average everyday Australian mother.
Well, that is the intriguing thing, that people in her circle, Erin presented to them as being kind of a normal mum. It her guests really just couldn't conceive that this person could do, you know, would do this, and neither did those sort of in her circle. So there is a sort of familiar, and I guess there is something about horror stories. Often the scariest are those where there is that element of the familiar. There's a moment in the book where, you know, we all turn to each other and say, you know, this is someone we could know. And actually, it turned out that we did. It sort of by degree have all of these degrees of separation to
wow.
to Erin. Like I have I know lots of people who were at school with her. So it wasn't some sort of it's quite a middle class story in some ways. It's not a story, and I think maybe that is also part of the kind of fascination, because often crime stories, if you dig deeper, are in Australia are really often. You know, disappoint people in that the perpetrator, that there can be a whole lot of social factors and disadvantage that have actually kind of led to this perfect storm of a crime. And this is not the case here.
What convinced you to do this book anyway?
Well, look, you get in the car with Sarah Krasnstein and Helen Garner, and you're you know, straight away, I mean, you know, the pull of making something together was very strong. And we were having conversations which kind of sparked off each other and kept on building. And to my mind, we were sort of getting further together than we would have as lone wolves. I think that, you know, part of what our project could do, because we weren't meeting daily deadlines, was to actually stand back and look at this as a cultural phenomena and also talk about this in ways which are sort of more intimate. And I think also, you know, one of my co-writers, Sarah Krasnstein, said to me, it's not as though silence is exoneration. It's not as though by not engaging in the ethics of this or in the writing of it, that you sort of avoid it's one way to obviously to avoid these ethical questions, but actually, you know, by engaging in it, maybe you're doing something more useful in a sort of literary way. And I do think that we've made something which is actually interesting, just as much about the case is fascinating, obviously. But I guess it's about, to me, it's also about what happens when women talk.
Yes, yes,
exactly. And the kind of conversations about power and women's lives that in a way I hope do justice to this in a humane way.
Let's talk about those conversations. I mean, other than the fact that you've just described my ideal car ride, you know, in connect car.
Come at us next time.
Oh, Helen Garner in particular, her coverage of true crime is like no other I've ever read.
It was an amazing, amazing gift to be in the car with Helen. And in a way, this is a story, partly it's about mothers and daughters, I think.
Mm.
You know, the crime itself, but also, you know, Helen, in the face of this incredibly destructive, horrific act, I get, you know, in the car, there was this generous person and it was about, you know, making something creative and Helen passing on her wisdom to some writers coming behind her.
So you've ended up with a book of edited transcripts of your conversations, you know,
we have.
As you described it, to and from to Melbourne, to Morwell in the car. Like, so how did you settle on doing it that way via the transcripts?
Well, our conversations were, you know, seemed to us interesting, and we hoped that other people would find that to be the case as well. I think that you know, Helen had an expression that she really wanted to keep this project airborne, and I guess that there was a sort of, even though we're talking about something that's horrific, We were trying to do it in a way that had a kind of immediacy to it, that people would feel that they were in the car or in the courtroom too, grappling with the same dilemmas.
And on those dilemmas, what were the biggest discoveries or surprises or revelations that came from seeking answers to the initial questions for you?
Look, I felt that it's always you go to a court case and the people who were killed were obviously amazing family and community members, and their loss is so profound and was so deeply felt. So I suppose that there is this sort of Agatha Christie style element, you know, to this story from the outside. And when you get beyond that, it's just this sort of reverberation of why.
You're listening to Nightlife, Greta Lee Jackson with you. And with me is Chloe Hooper, one of the authors of The Mushroom Tapes, covering the Erin Patterson trial, along with Sarah Krasnostein and Helen Garner. Chloe, through your conversations that ended up in this book, what did you determine psychological motivations to be? And are they, in fact, universal? I know that's a difficult question because not everybody does what she did or has been convicted of doing.
Well, I guess what is universal is a kind of female rage.
Right.
And the way that women deal with that, I guess Helen has used the term often that they've sort of, a lot of women in their, to get through their daily lives, throttle back enormous amounts of aggression and kind of suck it up. And I think that that women were looking at this case from the outset, and felt a kind of fascination to somebody who had appeared to have, done what, seems unthinkable, but a lot of people, secretly might kind of consider. I mean, I think actually, probably historically, poison was a way that people dealt with husbands or relatives that caused them issues. And obviously, most women don't. Obviously, most homicides with female perpetrators actually are defensive around children, or they have suffered something themselves. Now, there's absolutely no sense that this is not the case in this situation. So we were sort of grappling, I suppose, with who this person was and how you could do such a thing to people who actually seem to love you and love your children and be supportive. And I think we were, it would be impertinent to try to actually sort of claim we understand Erin Patterson's psychology. But I do think that there were moments, in our conversation where we were kind of sparking off each other, and there are glints in those sparks of what a kind of a truth might be.
Let's talk about the victims, whose loss is felt very, very deeply, particularly in relation to the mother-daughter story.
Yes.
What was the relationship between, that you found out between Erin and her own mother and, one of her victims, who was sort of like a surrogate mother, in a way. Do you want to elaborate on that a little bit for us?
Well, it was striking to me that Erin's own mother was a professor of children's literature. And actually, we know Dr. Heather Scudder, and we know various people who were in Heather's classes, and they've said to us there were all sorts of strange connections in this case Greta said that Heather was their favourite lecturer. But in Erin's telling, her mother was a very oppressive figure. And some of Erin's storytelling is not necessarily so accurate. So, but it was interesting to me that Erin's mother was very interested in feminist theory. And she was also interested in stories which actually, are about, I mean, kids' stories are about, fables have meals which change in front of the diners. I mean, food is a kind of a way that people transform into other things, and be it there are these sort of magical dishes. And Erin herself had been a great reader as a child and as an adult. She'd had a bookstore at one point, so there was a sort of strange reverberations of storytelling. Then Erin, who was estranged from her mother, became very, very close to her husband's family, who she considered almost to be her surrogate parents. And I guess she also underwent a religious conversion. So there's a sort of, that's another sort of fascinating part of this story, the part that religion played. It seems as though we're grappling here. Suddenly in the car, we're grappling with kind of life, death, mothers, and God, and how all of these things weigh differently on this woman's psychology.
You weren't sure about visiting Erin Patterson's house as part of writing this book. You're essentially outvoted. What was that experience like? Take me through it.
There's a line in the book that, in a way, sometimes when we were having disagreements, it was as if we were externalizing, the different things that go through your head as a writer. I wasn't necessarily keen to do that drive, but actually, Sarah, in particular, felt that if you're going to write about a place and then actually you have to sort of, that's part of doing justice to it, actually. I mean, we weren't kind of, obviously a lot of the print journalists kind of have to give people what they want, and they were, outside everybody's houses kind of 24/7. So it was a sort of a different project that we had. I was sort of more reticent to do it, but I guess it puts into context, where this took place, where this lunch took place, that sort of we were writing about, essentially.
Right, right. And it can reveal so much, just logistics of a case when you do those. I guess
it does. It reveals. I mean, this is the kind of, this is just part of the working of a writer, I suppose, and working out, this is the milieu, or this is the neighborhood. This is how far the drive is to the shops. Those are kind of, I guess, they're awkward things to record yourself doing, because you have to be transparent in a book like this. Whereas if you're writing a narrative piece, those details are slipped in and it's kind of seamless, and you don't actually see, I suppose, the mechanics of how the story was made. So in a way, in this book, there's a kind of transparency to what true crime is, and where I think we're kind of trying to analyze what true crime is, why it's got this sort of absolutely massive reach and appeal, and also making it inadvertently or purposely at the same time.
appeal with women. That's mostly in the majority.
Absolutely. That's and it's the production of these stories, which be it through documentary or podcast or books, is almost sort of 85 to 90%, you know, the female audience. And it's really fascinating to try to work out what, you know, why are women tuning into these stories in such record numbers?
Why do you think it is? I still don't know.
You know, it's kind of interesting to me that Erin's mother was a children's literature professor, because fairy stories are, you know, quintessentially embedded in them is all of these kind of wisdoms and warnings. And I think that these true crime stories, actually people attach to them almost as if they are folk tales. They're cautionary stories in one way. I think that women really tend to empathize not only with the victim, who unfortunately is most often female, but also they are sort of interested in the murderer. I mean, the stories are about power. I guess that they're, you know, they're like Don't Walk Down That sort of, you know, Don't Go Off the Path in the Woods. Don't, you know, connect with a sociopath on Tinder or go into a, you know, down a scary, don't go into a scary motel or whatever. They function in these ways. I think that they're also escape, and I think that we are living in a, you know, in a world right now that is full, really confronting and frightening, and full of grief. And I think that in a way, people tuned into this story as an escape. And it's kind of horrific that that happened for the family, but in a strange way, people connected over this trial in a way that is kind of rare in Australian culture at the moment.
And, you know, something I found fascinating is that Erin herself was a part of...
Erin was an absolute
crime community. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
About the Kelly Lane case. She was in a Kelly Lane Facebook group. That's
well, that's right.
Yeah.
She she was a completely I wanted to say dyed in the wool. That's not quite right. She was completely fanatical about true crime, and that's where her friendships were with a group of other women who she'd met on Facebook, and they communicated daily about you know, their children and
They testified, didn't they?
Politics. These women testified in court. And that actually was a moment where I thought, okay, you know, whatever reticence I had, I for me, that was a sort of the green light flashed then, because it was a moment where it felt as though who was the author of this story? We had kind of like, it felt as though Erin's true crime story, after she... you know, that was most of what she did was to sort of research true crimes and then converse with other people online about them. And so actually, you know, I felt like we were suddenly following this river that she had, you know, we were all kind of swimming in this river that she'd made. And that was I felt that we needed to kind of look more closely at that and this phenomena.
Look, I mean, I hate to be crass, but there is some serious disconnect with reality going on. If you are a true crime fanatic and you end up making all the same mistakes, I mean, not mistakes, but you do the things that get other people quite...
Yeah, that is a bit, that I agree. It's quite ironic that Erin's device history, or her searches for death cat mushrooms and... her murder phones were in the end what, you know, one of the things that, I don't, you know, to use crime slang, kind of brought her down.
Burner phones and multiple stories and unverifiable explanations.
Yeah, well, she tried to wipe her devices and to sort of lose these you know, her search histories, and it was, you know, as you put it, you know, should have known, that's not always kind of possible.
But
We don't mean to laugh at it. It is horrific, but it gets to the point of absurdity, this case.
We kind of dealt with that as well. And in a way, this story has sort of everything in it: love, hate, God, food, and, huge amounts of pain, but also, you know, these kinds of like flecks of absurdity. But that's human life, isn't it?
Yes.
I mean, that's the case for all of us.
Mm.
I guess we do have to think, though, about, one of the criticisms of true crime is that it can desensitize us to murder. And you have to ask yourself whether or not that was the case for Aaron Patterson.
Yes, exactly right. I have my own thoughts on that particular argument, but you know, at the end of the day,
she's not a great advertisement for the genre. Let's put it that way.
At the end of the day, you know, real human lives were lost, and you know, communities suffered as a result. Families have suffered. Many, many victims of this act of Aaron's. But you know, when discussion turned to the children of Aaron Patterson and her ex, Simon, how did you feel about them? How did you cover them in the book as well?
Look, we've tried not to go into a lot of detail.
Yeah.
We all feel strongly that the kind of vengeance that Aaron, exacted really will land at their feet, and that's something we didn't want to sort of draw out, and I think that's very kind of clear and painful. We want characters to be black and white, clearly good and bad, and most often that isn't the case with humans,
right?
Yet in this story, actually, Aaron's family, her victims, were all incredibly good people who spent their days trying to help others and were very involved in their church, but also in the community. Her mother-in-law was involved in a program amongst the works she did volunteering, reading to the blind in the community. Her mother-in-law's sister taught refugees English. Her father-in-law was a very beloved teacher and mentor to a lot of people. So I guess the Baptists believe you need to walk with Jesus every day. And these were people who lived godly lives, and their loss is profound.
And I'll just add, look, I don't know if I'll include this in what we air, but there was absolutely no reason for them to say yes to this dinner invitation to their relative, their son's and nephew's ex-wife's lunch. They didn't need to be doing it. They didn't need to be in contact with her. There was no obligation to be there, and yet they were.
I think that these things are always complicated when there are children involved, aren't there?
Yes.
So, I don't mean this to sound flippant, but you actually can't choose your relatives.
Yeah.
And we are enmeshed in relationships that are complicated and that are unpredictable, and we do our best, and breakups are painful, and I think they were trying very, very hard to do the best thing by their daughter-in-law, because they, Simon and Aaron, were still married, and those kids.
I just think that it just speaks to what kind of people they were. That's
absolutely
all. Yeah. They were still showing up for her.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Well, you're listening tonight live. Greta Lee Jackson with you. With me is Chloe Hooper, who is one of the authors of The Mushroom Tapes, covering the Aaron Patterson trial. Chloe, Helen Garner gave you the nickname Tough Old Boss. How did you get that reputation?
Isn't that funny? Well, I think that, you know, Helen might revise that now. I guess I was the sort of the sheepdog in the project to some degree, trying to corral everyone. But I think she now sort of, you know, often calls me a brick, and I don't think she means that as a sort of you know, something that's very hard. I think she just means solid by that. So hopefully fortifying. But you know, I guess if you're Helen Garner's boss, then that's you know, you've got to wear that as a badge of honor. It's great to talk to you, Greta, because I feel like we could keep going for hours. It is a story that engages you on and you know, women, let's say, of a particular age and stage in a very we're kind of activated by it.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.